And we'll make sure to do it for you.
Wait, wait, how come there's nobody? All right, I think we have a quorum, so we will get going with our MTC Policy Advisory Council meeting for Wednesday, April 9th. Welcome, everyone. And it looks like we have a slightly lighter group today, but that's okay. First order of business is approval of the March minutes, and I will take a motion for that from Linda and a second from Vita. Great. All in favor? All opposed?
I'm abstaining.
And with one abstention, any abstentions other than Randy? All right. With that, they're approved. All right, so at this point, I don't have any public comment cards, but we'll take public comment on items not on the agenda. All right, with that, we'll move forward to subcommittee reports. So, Naomi? She'll give us the report on the Equity and Access Subcommittee.
Okay, thank you. So the Equity Access Committee met a little earlier this afternoon, and our primary item was follow-up from our February meeting that we had with the Joint Commission Policy Advisory Council work plan. We were tasked by Commissioner Spearing with looking at some best practices for paratransit and paratransit alternatives, and to sort of begin to think about how that might work and how we can then bring that forward to the main committee. So we had some great sort of initial brainstorms, and Pam provided some preliminary materials for us from the coordinated plan and the I'm not going to tell you the whole name, it's really long, the transit sustainability project, the paratransit portion. Was there anything else I missed? Okay. And so we're kind of going to review those as homework and continue to discuss this topic, maybe bring in some subject experts or maybe go on some field trips, but try to come up with some suggestions for what we can then bring forward to this larger committee. As always, we welcome your input in the Equity Access Committee. All of you new members, anyone is welcome to join. Just let Pam know, and whether you are officially on it or not, you're always welcome to attend. Did I miss anything? Okay, thank you.
Thank you. All right, so we will now continue with our Policy Advisory Council orientation, which has sort of been on pause over the last couple of months as we've been developing the work plan. So we'll hear from Melanie Crotty on this. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Again, my name is Melanie Crotty, and I'm the Director of Operations at MTC. And it's really my pleasure to be here this afternoon. I haven't been forward to this council for, I think, a couple of years now. So there's a lot of new faces around the table, so it's really great to be back. I think I may be the last section to come forward to you, is that right, Pam, to talk about this. So hopefully you'll feel fully briefed on the various sections of MTC. And the way I'm proposing to go through the work on my section maybe is a little different from some of the other sections, where I thought I'd take advantage of a commission workshop that we had last month. I think Commissioner Jacopini was there, so she can probably critique the different feedback that as I go through this. But I did take advantage of a presentation that staff gave to commissioners at a workshop at the end of March, and tried to use those slides here. So I will, as I go through the presentation, also try and provide some of the comments or feedback that we got from our commissioners based on that meeting. So first of all, this slide, I think, is trying to provide the context of what operations does at MTC. And really, it's the story starts back in the 1970s when MTC was first created. We really had a very kind of narrow focus as a regional planning agency, some funding. And certainly over time, our role has changed quite dramatically. And if you want to really talk about it from a physical aspect, really, MTC has two floors. The third floor is our traditional planning function, and the second floor is the new stuff, the operational staff. And it really has changed the face of the agency quite a bit since the 1970s. The first operational activities we took on were primarily through the SAFE program, the Service Authority for Freeways and Expressways, delivering call boxes and the Freeway Service Patrol program. And then over time, we've taken on a greater role in operating services and managing aspects of the toll bridges. And so I'll get into more details on all of these. The last point in this slide is that I think where we really are, and really the discussion that we had with our commissioners last month, was we have taken on a set of somewhat disparate activities. And is the time right now for us to talk about how we want to more collectively assume some responsibility? Primarily, this is in partnership with Caltrans. Do we want to look at a different type of partnership with them? Do we want to take, you know, get more bang for our buck and look at greater synergies for managing the transportation system in the Bay Area? And so that really was the question we were asking our commissioners, and hopefully you'll kind of get a sense of that as I go through this presentation. So first of all, again, this is a slide from the commission workshop. This is just to kind of provide a high-level overview of what the components of freeway management look like. There's three major functional areas, by our definition at least: incident management, freeway management, and field equipment. And MTC has a role in all pieces of this. In some places, we're very active. Others, it's certainly more of a supportive role. Incident management, as I mentioned, the SAFE program, we certainly have a long-term relationship and very well-defined with CHP and Caltrans in that. The other two is that I would say they're still more in an evolving state. But to draw your attention to the lower right-hand corner of this slide with the purple title, Operations and Maintenance, and you see below that there's this thing, a lot of initials, TMS MOU. That's the Transportation Management System Memorandum of Understanding, a lot of initials there. We just signed an MOU with Caltrans in December, just a few months back, that was confirming or I guess really kind of establishing our interest in pursuing a new and better partnership with Caltrans on managing the transportation management system. And right now we're in the process of developing this action plan for that, and we expect later this year to execute a master co-op agreement where we are looking at this new partnership. So the timing for today, I think, is really good because we're really in the middle of all this thinking right now. So what I thought I'd do now in the next few slides is talk about, I said that we're doing a lot of disparate activities that we're hoping to take better advantage of their synergies, and so I'm going to start explaining the building blocks to you. So right here is the, this slide is MTC's express lanes. And by way of explanation, the BAFA in parentheses, let me just remind all of you in case you're not familiar with that. BAFA is a joint powers authority of MTC and BATA. And we have elected to implement the express lanes through BAFA. And so that's really kind of administrative decision that if people are interested, I can explain. But I think for the purposes right now, I'll just leave it at that that's the committee, if you will, that is managing the decision making for the express lane program on behalf of MTC and BATA. So the express lanes, as a reminder what they are, it's a single lane where for the first phase we're converting existing carpool lanes over to the express lane concept. It is a dynamic toll that allows single occupant drivers to have legal access to the carpool lane. Carpools and buses will remain free. And in the Bay Area, the configuration that we're going to be proposing for our express lanes is called an open access configuration. And I'll get into more details on that in the next couple slides. So this next slide is a map that shows where our MTC express lanes will be operating. We had to get approval from the California Transportation Commission, the CTC, for our authority, and they gave us authority for 270 miles. Of that, 150 miles were already existing carpool lanes, and that's what we're calling what the green ones are. And those are going to be more straightforward to deliver because it's a simple conversion from a carpool lane to an express lane. So those will be happening first, and that's why they're called Tier 1. And then we do have an additional 120 miles that we will have the authority to build. So essentially we'll be adding carpool lanes but opening them as an express lane. Now, maybe as a reminder about the express lanes, why is MTC doing express lanes? There's existing capacity in the carpool lanes today that we're not able to use. And so this is a way to give travelers a choice. If they want to have the opportunity for improved mobility, they can buy their trip to get into the express lanes. We then plan to use that revenue to expand the system so that the first phase will essentially help us pay for the second phase of the system. So the ultimate goal is to have a connected HOV system or HOT system in the region so that it'll provide better service for buses. Express bus service will have continuous access as well as the carpoolers. The timing for all this is that we are looking to have the first set of conversions done pretty quickly. The first lane is going to be on Interstate 680 in Contra Costa County, and that will be opening in early 2016. So as far as our ability to move move rather nimbly by having the conversions, it does allow us to move a little more quickly. This slide, this is just kind of explaining how the express lanes will look. So this first example, this is how the HOV lane looks today, where it's something that hopefully is familiar to all of you. For Northern California, we have the dashed line separating the carpool lane from the regular mixed flow lanes. And you can see this is how it works. It's called open access, right? So here's this next example is for what it looks like for express lanes. From a physical appearance, it's not that different. You still get a sense of the open access, and now the diamonds have been changed to a labeling of express lanes. And again, from a usability perspective, the open access allows the cars to access ingress and egress easily from the express lanes. Now, the last piece I want to explain that what we are looking at in certain elements of our express lanes corridors is we will be putting in some restrictions. So if you're familiar with the carpool lanes in Southern California, there will be some areas of the region that will look more like that. And that's really from our operations analysis. There are certain parts of the region that, because of the weaving going in and out of the lane, that actually it causes the whole corridor to degrade, and that by putting in double stripes, so there's nothing physical, it'll just be paint, but putting in those double stripes to forbid people to weave at those points, it will improve the overall operations of not only the express lane, but also of the mixed flow lanes. And so that you will be seeing in some areas this double line. And here's just the example of what that looks like, where the cars will not be allowed to weave in and out at those points. So the next program I want to talk a little bit about was our Freeway Performance Initiative. This program has a very kind of basic goal of using technology to better manage the freeway system with low-cost solutions. Primarily, looking at bottlenecks and incidents, and so safety and mobility being its goals. We have been installing ramp meters in cooperation with Caltrans, and you perhaps have seen those. And I would say that this is not that innovative a concept. It certainly has been in operation in other parts of the countries, Los Angeles, Chicago. They've been operating ramp meters since the 1960s. So the Bay Area has really only started catching up with this in the 2000s. So the effectiveness of this is pretty well known and documented, and it's just a matter of us kind of catching up with that. So the next two slides I have is to really show what the status of the metering looks like in our region. I don't know if this may be a little hard for you to read, but I think maybe to point out some kind of important things. That the color that looks kind of, I don't know, it's kind of the bright lime green, those are the activated ones. And you can see there's quite a bit of activation in Santa Clara County, 880, and then other parts of the region. Probably the most important takeaway is that we do have a lot on the books that we are planning to activate. We've been working with Caltrans as they've had construction projects throughout the region, And they've been installing this equipment as kind of opportunistically as other programs have come up. And so that's really allowed us to get a head start on this. This next slide for the ramp metering, I think, really is like looking ahead. That the if you look at what's yellow on here, that's really what's not funded and what we are going to be evaluating in the future. Hello. that we'll be evaluating in the future as possible new corridors or intersections to have the metering. We don't have funding for all this, so this is just the areas that really are not yet metered. And so obviously the criteria would be some kind of performance-based evaluation. What are the most congested areas that don't have metering? And or, I mean, I do want to emphasize the value of the safety benefits of metering, that even in areas where there isn't heavy congestion, metering can provide benefits by evening the flow out of traffic merging onto the freeway, and it provides real safety benefits from that. So we'll be looking forward to working with Caltrans on recommending the next tranche of these meters in the coming year. So what's next? What's up next as far as the Freight Performance Initiative is really taking things beyond the ramp meter I talked about. Adaptive ramp metering is kind of the next big thing. That really is where the technology is moving, where it really is evaluating the conditions of the freeway at the moment and adapting the metering rate in response to what the conditions are. So this is most valuable where there is big fluctuations and you really are seeing changes in the conditions of the freeway. There are there are hard benefits that you can get from this as well. You know, I think that based on studies, they're saying you can improve travel times up to 10%. And again, our agencies to the south have really been leaders in this, and we're looking to take their lead in this and see what we can get done here. Beyond that, there are other traffic management strategies that we are kind of throwing out there to start getting the reaction of Caltrans, as well as this was something that came up at our commission workshop. Ideas about taking advantage of shoulders where there are good shoulders around the region. Do we want to try, and it's called hard shoulder running. Do you want to take advantage of that shoulder to use for additional capacity during the peak hour? This is done in other parts of the country. Variable speed limits is another thing that when congestion is really bad or there's an accident, if you have that technology available, you can adjust the speed. So there's a lot of other ideas that are low-cost solutions that actually can improve the mobility of the region that we'd like to continue to explore and see what kind of synergies and benefits we can come from implementing some of these low-cost strategies. And I think... I kind of jumped ahead and talked a lot about this stuff. I would just note, if you look at the picture here, the overhead on the freeway, the gantry there, that's just kind of example of the signage for kind of the lane management aspect about whether you could actively change the lane to this is where you could change the speed. You could talk about the carpool lane or not throughout the day, and then the this is a hard shoulder running example here, where they're taking advantage of the existing shoulder and making it used just during the peak commute hour. So quickly, maybe going through a couple other programs. We have the PASS program, Programs for Arterial System Synchronization, where we about 500 signals every year are get funding from this program. They're retimed, and it provides mobility benefits for arterials, improves. It's a nice multimodal program because it improves not only for cars, but it's transit, it's bikes, it's peds. It really has a great benefit across the board. And we have about $2 million in funding that we provide to local jurisdictions for that. The SAFE program, I've mentioned that at the beginning of the presentation. We have two parts of that. We have the call box program, motorist aid, as well as the freeway service patrol, which provides assist to motorists when they have trouble on the freeway. These programs are, I think, longstanding. FSP in particular is probably one of our most popular programs that MTC operates. Who wouldn't like to have other parts of the country call them freeway angels, so I think that speaks for itself. People are, there's someone that comes in and helps you when you're in times of need on the freeway. As far as the call box program, this is an area that we've been managing very closely as we've seen the you know, just the explosion in growth and cell phones through the past 10 years, it really calls into question the value of call boxes. We've worked closely with our SAFE committee as well as with CHP and Caltrans to examine what's the right fit for us as far as the number of call boxes. So it was December 2012, about a year and a half ago or so, we did come to our commission with a reduction program that was approved by them. And essentially what we were trying to do is in urban areas, we know that we don't need, that there's a less, the cell phone coverage is better there, so that the need for the call box is less there, and you know, kind of conversely is true in the rural areas, that there's some areas where the cell phone coverage is not as well. So we are just now proceeding with this reduction program. We're kind of going every other call box is what we're reducing. And that's going to take us, I think, through the end of the summer to get that reduction. The other piece of this program is that we're actually experimenting in one urban corridor where we remove all the call boxes. What's kind of been interesting as we look at that part of the program is that a couple of the urban corridors essentially have really had pretty big reductions already due to some major construction work that's occurred on there. If you're familiar at all, for example, with 880, there's so much construction that I think more than half the call boxes have already been reduced because of the construction. So we're monitoring this closely. I think, I would say that the CHP is kind of watching over our shoulder, because they certainly they want to make sure that there are call boxes available. But the role that MTC has is really to ensure, as far as like a judicious use of these are vehicle license fees, to make sure that we're using those wisely, that if we can save on call boxes, we can invest those same dollars in other programs to protect motorists. And there's other safety aspects that we could pursue in the event that we don't have to spend them on call boxes that no one's using. I'm about to wrap up here. This is the 511 program. We've been doing this for over 10 years. In case you don't know what it is, it's a website and it's a phone number we can call to get information about how to get around on transit or how to get information on congestion in the freeway system. We also have an app for our transit trip planner. We have a great real-time transit departure information service, so it has a whole lot of information and services. And I think from this chart, maybe the last point I would just make, that it also has been a pretty important go-to tool in times of emergencies. And we, I guess most recently, the one to comment was on last year, was during the BART strike, where 511 really delivered a lot of information to travelers that needed to make different trip decisions based on the lack of BART service. So this is the final slide, and this is really, I wanted to go back to where I started and mention in discussing that we had this workshop with our commissioners last month. The point of the slide is really, I think, a couple, that MTC is already doing a lot of different transportation management strategies to improve the experience for the Bay Area traveling public. We might not be as effective or as efficient as we like because it's more fragmented. Our goal is really to understand by having a different partnership with Caltrans, would this allow us to do things better? Would allow us to be more nimble in implementing certain ideas, certain activities in a way that would keep our costs down, provide an improved mobility service to the traveling public, and really in a faster time frame? The feedback from our commissioners was that they really felt comfortable that Caltrans should remain as the owner of the basic facilities and the physical assets. I think that what really, for staff right now, what we really need to be pursuing and thinking about is, well, with that as kind of our context, what is it that we should be doing differently with Caltrans? You know, to be blunt, that in a lot of cases, there's just a lot of red tape that the normal Caltrans process requires us to go through, and when you want to do, you know, talking about the express lane conversions, that doing something that should be simple and provide a benefit to the traveling public, you really can raise the cost quite a bit by kind of going through that normal process. So I think MTC is really interested in experimenting with Caltrans to see if there's a different way to get to innovate on these projects and to get things done quickly with a lower cost profile. And that's really kind of our primary objective in this search for a new partnership. So I think that is my last slide. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
I would ask one clarifying question before turning it over to Rich, and that you kind of clarified for me by saying different partnership. You meant relinquishment of these corridors?
Well, I think that was the question, initially, like, should we, if we look at a different type of ownership proposition with Caltrans, could that include as much as, actually owning the facilities?
All right, thank you. Rich Hedges was the first hand that I saw.
Yeah,
I've
had at least two questions. Thank you. My mother just stayed home today. I'm thinking you take care of me.
Mm-hmm. We'll get to the question.
Okay, leave me alone. The first one is I've actually experienced some of the lanes in Southern California. You can't get on them without a transponder. There's two lanes on the 110, and there's one, I haven't been on it, but I understand there's one on the 110, the east-west, and the question I have is, have we communicated with them about how it's working? Have they seen an increase in transit? Because I believe that may happen based on the backups now in the lanes that you don't have to have a transponder. Not that there weren't already tremendous backups.
Uh-huh.
Well, and my other question is, when are we going to turn the lights on the ramp metering in San Mateo County again?
Well, let's see. So as far as the Express Lane program, yes, we are certainly in close communications with all of the Express Lane facility operators in California. There's actually a statewide California committee that we're a member of. I forgot to mention this. It was actually in the slide, but I kind of skipped over it, that we are proposing a use of a switchable toll tag for the Express Lane. So this is kind of an important mm-hmm. thing to talk about. If you haven't heard, that there's a little switch on the toll tag that you can switch to one or to two or three, so that you and then we'll be able to automatically know what your car is being registered at.
Yeah.
The value of that is it really makes enforcement much more straightforward. All users of the Express Lane will be required to have a fast track toll tag. If you're a carpooler, you need to get one, you put it on two or three. And so you don't pay anything, but it's just you need to have that tag so that CHP knows to look, okay, if it signals that you're a carpool, then they will visually inspect to see if that looks like it's a carpool. It's something similar to what we've already doing on the Bay Bridge. So this is kind of an extension of an existing concept. They are doing this as well in Los Angeles on the 110, so that they have already kind of broken that ground on the switchable tag concept. We have a huge leg up on them in that we already have an experienced population who already has fast track and who already has fast track for carpooling. So I think that we are at a huge advantage to the learning curve that they had to go through when they introduced it in LA. But that being said, we're continuing to work with them to understand their lessons learned and really to coordinate and communicate to figure out the fact that our HOV facilities are different. Makes because they have the restrictions I talked about versus our carpool lane being different, that does there are some differences that we need to recognize between the north and the south. So as far as the success or not of that program, I don't know about how transit's doing. I can look into that for you. I know that overall, as far as the opening, that there was a drop in the usage of the lane itself when they opened it up, because I think people were trying to figure out the fast track piece, because again, they don't need it in Southern California if they don't have toll bridges. So that experience, I don't think we will have the same, but then over time it has built up and they're very pleased with its progress right now.
Yeah, it takes 50 minutes for me to get downtown from Southern Los Angeles County on the Blue Line. It takes me about 2.5 hours if I take transit. I just park when I go to LA.
Wow.
I don't drive.
Was that
And then you had the other question about the ramp meters in San Mateo County.
My understanding is the ramp meters are not on. I don't see them on at all in San Mateo County. When are we going to turn them back on?
I'm not aware. I mean, they've been on. You're saying the ones that have been on are turned off now?
I don't see them unless it's just not enough traffic.
I don't know. I'll have to look into that because that's I mean, there are elements of San Mateo County where they're still putting in new meters, which is different, obviously, because they have meters that have been in operation. So I'll have to look into that. I haven't heard that they were turned off.
Okay.
I don't believe they are.
Hopefully I'm mistaken.
Yeah, I don't believe they are.
All right. So we've got Will and then Randy. No, Will?
I had a couple of questions. Did I understand you correctly that only some of the access points on the express lanes are going to be controlled? That if you go back to that diagram, it looked like, because the ones in Santa Clara County are all, I believe, control access points. So I'm wondering what the purpose of having like a free-flowing in and out might be.
Well, there's a couple of reasons for it. One is since our existing HOV lanes are already configured that way by having open access, it makes it easier to educate for the express lanes user. It's not different from how you're using today, essentially. So that was a primary motivation. A second reason is by not having to change it, it kept the cost down too. And so that also was very important to us.
Because it just seems to me that it's going to encourage that I'm going to hop over here for a few minutes and hop back, that hopping in and out. So that would be my concern of us not looking long-term and making sure that all access points are, I mean, starting it out that way, but with the intention of securing the ability to control that.
Well, we do have a strategy to address that. I don't know if it will fix it completely, but the pricing is called zone-based pricing. And essentially, rather than you being kind of charged when you go in once, once you go in and the reader gets you, you're paying for a zone. And so let's say it costs $3. You're going to get charged $3 whether you're in the lane for 10 meters or for the entire length of that zone, which will be, I think it can be 3 to 6 miles, something like that.
Okay.
So that by having already incurred that sunk cost, I think people will learn there's no value to pop in and out. It'll be very hard to game the system.
Okay.
That's the idea.
Okay, hopefully. My second question is on ramp metering and the downstream effects or the upstream effects of ramp metering. Because this was something that I warned everybody that was involved in the process where they went in around where I live, was the backup that has now been generated has taken our upstream intersections and taken them from D ratings to F ratings. So you're having to cycle through as you're waiting for the metering lights to push people onto the freeway. Farther upstream, you're sitting there waiting for that traffic to clear out. So there's the traffic issue. And the fact that these ramp meters are going in adjacent to residential neighborhoods means that there's increased idling time in those neighborhoods. And I guess I'm trying to figure out how we can address that and how we can go back and revisit some of those. Because I was promised a traffic study that hasn't shown back up, and if it's creating problems in just my area, then I know it's going to create problems on a regional basis in spot areas. So to be able to prioritize, say, signals that work differently upstream so that we can move some of that traffic out of there, because it's expensive to reconfigure something that way, and if it's a result of the metering, if the excess traffic is a result of the metering, then really I think it's our responsibility as sponsors of that metering to make sure that we address those issues. So how would that happen, and where would that come in?
Well, gosh, there was a lot in that, so let me know if I'm not answering all parts of it. So, first of all, as far as the ramp metering, ours is now just time of day. So it's not, as I mentioned, it's not the most sophisticated. So that I think that as we look to the next generation of these programs and services, we'll be able to do a better job of addressing a lot of the concerns that you expressed there. Right now, what we do is we have these time of day plans, and we monitor them. And in cases where the ramps start to fill up and spill onto the local streets, we have to adjust them, or sometimes we can't. We have to change it so that more cars are entering the freeway. Essentially, reduce what the value of the metering is to the freeway because it's having too great an impact on the local street. So that's what's supposed to be happening. That as part of these studies that we do look at the size of the meter and what kind of capacity does it have for storage of vehicles to make sure that it's enough. In many cases, we're actually adding another lane to the ramp. You know, primarily it's HOV bypass lanes, but that does add capacity to the ramp to help address the impact on the local arterial. So that's kind of what we're doing today. In the future, what we do want to do and are looking to use the PASS program I talked about, kind of the next generation of that, is to have traffic signals that do a better job of communicating with the metering so that there is more of this connected system so that what you talk about we can do a better job of. But we're not there yet.
So that kind of answered the question, but if you say that's what we're doing today, I want to know, so if the meter goes in and it's initiated on January 1st, when can I expect somebody to come back and go, oh, wow, it's backing up on all the arterials and we need to fix or adjust or try and make the arterials flow better?
I would say, if you want me to follow up with you about your specific situation afterwards, I'd be happy to, but I would say it should have already been done if it was January 1st.
It's been like 2 years, so... and it's just getting worse, and that's my concern because it's a high pedestrian area. So, okay, I'll talk to you afterwards. Thank you.
Okay.
Carlos.
Yes, I wanted to focus on the last slide. I'm not sure if you wanted us to kind of give you some input on. I don't know if that was for the previous meeting, but mine is more kind of a comment and question at the same time because it sounds like. Throughout the presentation, you've given us a lot of examples of where it's being done or where it's been done either pioneered or already in place for many years throughout the country. And I guess the question about MTC owning or taking a more active role in operating, I'm curious as to the examples, say, in Southern California where you have the express lanes and I think you even have some toll roads and are those multi-jurisdictional? Is Caltrans running them, or are there local jurisdictions that are running them? And same thing with the idea of like the ramp metering and all these technologies. And I think you mentioned the one in Seattle where you have the different lanes. So I was curious to find out how are they being maintained and operated?
You know, I think the short answer is that we're behind, and the irony is we're the home of Silicon Valley, right? And they're not. But for whatever reason, these operational strategies, and I think California is behind a lot of other places in the country, these operational strategies have not been given enough priority in our region and in our state. And we have been stuck, I think, still too much in the mentality that when there's a problem on the freeway, our solution is to build some more freeway. And as you all know, in the Bay Area, we've run out of money for the most part. We've run out of right-of-way in many places. We've run out of patience just for how long it takes. So we were trying to be fairly provocative with the commission, and we provoked them all right. But what we were trying to say is that we really need a new business model for how we operate our freeway system. And whether it's Caltrans or MTC or the Policy Advisory Council, whoever is going to run this show, we need to be willing to take more chances. We need to be willing to try some things and see if they don't work and then stop doing them. Quick story, the best example I've got on this subject is ramp metering. I think it was in Minneapolis. And there was a certain state senator who was just determined to get rid of ramp metering. He was certain that it was screwing everything up and it was the worst idea in the world. And so the head of the state DOT decided to call his bluff. And so he said, look, we're going to turn them off for a month and we'll see who's right. And after a week, this state senator and every other one was pleading with them to turn them back on. And it's just the power of experimentation and trying something. So I do think that is a large part of the challenge. And it's not just a challenge for Caltrans. It's a challenge for us because we're traditionally a planning organization. You'd be hard-pressed to find Melanie at another MPO, much less Melanie and a whole section of people doing what she does. So it's all of us, I think, looking at the freeway system in a new way. That's why we think these express lanes are so exciting, because it's really not about raising money. We may not raise much at all. It's about getting more folks through that capacity that we've already built. So I think the other answer to your question is the governance models are very different from place to place. A lot of these express lanes in Southern California, in fact, all of them, have been advocated and in large part implemented by the local agency, not by Caltrans. That's how we've done it here. We've got two local ones, and ours is essentially a regional version of local. I think Caltrans right now is going through the same sort of exercise about, well, what do we want to do now that we've built all these capital projects and our money's running dry? So I think we're all headed toward the same place. It's just going to be a little messy and awkward for a while we sort out who's supposed to do what.
And thank you, because that's exactly what I wanted to kind of... I don't know the answer on this either. I'm just thinking, I wonder if there's starting to become kind of an analogy to like the transit operators, you know, where you have every locality kind of, you know, running their own service. And then I'm not advocating right here that MTC needs to take it over or that Caltrans does, but I'm just, as I hear, that's what I wanted to hear. It sounds like, I remember in Santa Clara, they already have their toll roads down there. And so that, yeah, so I figured there's going to be a lot of interjurisdiction.
Well, that is on express lanes why we wanted to get into the game, because we did sort of see, you know, two dozen transit operators sprouting up, and we said, oh, my God, we can't do that again. As it is, I think we're probably going to have two different operators in the region, one in Santa Clara and one in the rest of it, which isn't the ideal solution, but two is better than 24, so I'll take that.
Chris, and then Linda.
Thank you. I have two questions. First of all, on the express lanes, I may have missed this, but are you talking about using adjustable congestion pricing to keep these lanes from becoming as congested as the rest of the freeway? And my other question is on the call boxes, are there any potential liability issues from removing call boxes?
Well, certainly for the first one, we are fully expecting that, and that's a chief attribute of the express lanes, is to have dynamic tolling so that you can raise the price when there's high congestion. The goal of the express lane really is to provide a reliable trip, and to really to do that, you need to have the dynamic toll. I'm still learning a lot about this myself, actually, but you know, it's really important to have the right algorithms so that you are setting the price right. So we're fully expecting to kind of have a kind of weaning in period as we kind of understand the traffic patterns for each corridor and how people respond to the tolls that we set. But the goal will be to ensure that you'll be able to get through that corridor without sitting in the same congestion that the mixed flow lanes are. Second question about the liability. You know, I don't think that we have that. We don't have a huge concern about that. That part of our monitoring of the call box system is really we've seen the plummeting of its usage, and so that it just kind of changes the liability situation if some people aren't using it right now today. I'm sure there will be cases where people can say that if there was a call box there, they could have used it. But you know, when you look at it from a system-wide perspective, I think that there's still kind of the basic fact of the cost it costs to operate the system versus the number of people that actually use it. It's just the facts are there.
Linda, and then Ben.
Am I on? Yeah. Okay. I kind of wanted to follow up a little bit on the toll lanes that are being built supposedly in on 580. A lot of the problem with 580 are people coming over from San Joaquin County, and I'm wondering, are we looking at doing some kind of a partnership with them or bringing them into our system? I can think of a whole bunch of reasons to do it, including transportation.
I'm not sure we are. I think we're going to take their money if they want to use our lanes. But essentially what you're going to see, I think, Linda, with these express lanes, because what we're trying to do is knit together a system, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the trouble with our current HOV system is it's not quite a system yet. There are still gaps. And so part of our challenge here is to fill those gaps. And the financing strategy we're going to use is voluntary contributions. And if we get enough of them, we'll be able to fill the gaps. If we don't, we're sort of back in the soup with every other project that doesn't have enough public money. So where they will be going in the first wave and where yours are being built on 580 are in heavily congested locations.
I guess.
But I don't think you necessarily need them for the entire length of any facility. You really need to get them from a set of origins to a set of destinations, but not necessarily coast to coast or state line to state line or anything like that.
Well, that brings me sort of to my other suggestion. I know that we talked before about where is all this money going to go that's collected. If the money collected goes to the areas that are most needed, then the money that's collected from 580 will come back to 580.
Yeah, that's one of the toughest ones that we're going to have to deal with in this whole thing. When you think about the paradigm that we use to build the interstate system, we spread the money around, right? So we took money from California and spent it in Iowa, and we took money from Nebraska and spent it in New Mexico because we were building a nationwide network. And if we had insisted that only the money that Nebraska raised would build Nebraska's part of the interstate, we wouldn't have finished the interstate system. So we needed to pool the funds. I believe that we have a similar situation here, where if you want to have a network, and the network benefits everybody the best, right, because you have a network, then you're going to have some limited kind of pooling of funds. I think you could probably pull it off by corridor. So if you take 680, you know, 680 goes a long way from Solano down to Santa Clara. I would define that as one corridor. So if you buy that definition, I think we could probably say that we'll be reinvesting in the corridor. If your definition is 680 from Red Top Road to Fairfield, I think we're going to have a hard time making that work. But I think the members of our board are really going to be, they're going to be Hawkeyes about this. They are really going to watch that question carefully. And I think it's especially relevant if we have excess revenue, right? Our first challenge is to get this system built. If we can get it built and it has excess revenue, that'll be a great food fight to have. But if we never get the system built, because we have to extract revenue by county or by jurisdiction or something else, I just think we'll have missed a real opportunity.
Well, just to keep in mind that the people in the community are looking at the toll road, basically, that's being built is taking the place where BART was supposed to come. They're going to want that money back. So just a thought.
Yeah, I know. But remember, too, when people use these roads, your question started out with San Joaquin, right?
Mm,
I mean,
yes.
There are a lot of folks who use 580 who aren't from Alameda County at all.
That's right.
And so, you know, they have, you might say, some kind of political claim on that revenue, too.
Mm-hmm.
So I do think we need to try to keep at least a corridor focus on how we invest funds so that we can try to build a network. And not just pieces in particular places.
I think we'll take Ben and then Rich, and I think then we'll probably wrap it up for this topic.
I've got a question about the express lanes and then a comment about the ramp metering. So my first question is, I was a little bit unclear. Is the expectation that all carpools and motorcycles would have to carry a tag just to use the HOV lane?
Yeah, that is correct. That is different from today, that we're going to need to require anyone that wants to have free access to get the tag, and so they can then switch it to HOV 2 or 3, and that does include motorcycles. So part of the program will be to really to reach out to those communities and make sure that they have an opportunity to get the toll tag. And I think that certainly when we begin the operations, there's going to be a grace period so that people kind of have an opportunity to catch up and understand. So they'll just be given a warning. We do have the regional rideshare program database, so we'll be able to mine that and be able to tell who travels along certain corridors where they live. And so there are ways for us to be able to reach out to the communities and to try and get in front of this.
Obviously, I commute via motorcycle quite often, and I think that the toll tag use on a motorcycle is difficult. So while going over the Bay Bridge, most other motorcycles that I know just leave the tag at home and rely solely upon the cameras to catch the license plate info, because it doesn't fit in your pocket, and you can stick it underneath your seat, which is a metal box, which it doesn't work anyway, so you just leave it at home. I think that trying to figure out that component, because I know that on the 880 corridor, there's a lot of motorcyclists who are trying to make that work. So it can be difficult that you can carry it, but it doesn't work because it's a metal box.
We encourage using cloth bags, so it works.
Well, I mean, you can stick it in a cloth bag, but then you put the cloth bag. There's a metal compartment underneath your seat where you put stuff, but it's metal on the bottom, it's metal on top. So you can put it in a cloth bag and then stick it in a metal box, and it kind of negates the cloth bag.
Well, we certainly are aware of this concern from the community. That's one of the lessons that we've learned from Southern California as well. We've heard about that. I think we're encouraging motorcyclists to carry a toll tag, but I will say that we will also have the camera enforcement as well. So we will be able to read license plates.
Yeah, and I found that the CHP officers are pretty, you know, they understand that you're not carrying them on the Bay Bridge. And I think most motorcyclists don't want a hard object that can shatter in their pocket if there is an accident, which can be dangerous as well. The other comment I have is on ramp metering. I think obviously ramp metering is a great tool to manage flow. I don't know if this has come up, but that it also seems to advantage those who live further away from their destination points. So, you know, if you are in downtown Oakland and you're sitting in a ramp meter line, it's advantaging those who are living in San Leandro. I mean, it's advantaging people who live further away from their destinations. And I see that in a lot of areas, you know, down in Hayward and Fremont, where you can sit and you're watching people who live, you know, who've chosen to live 20 minutes further out, sitting there, and you're sitting in traffic for 5 minutes, even though you've chosen to live a 5 minute freeway drive to your work. And I think that there's a piece of that that feels like you're encouraging the wrong behavior, although it does increase traffic flow.
I don't entirely disagree with you. Just a couple comments in that as you saw from our map, we do have an aspiration to meter most of the region, so that I think that eventually most people that use the freeway will be experiencing a meter. So there will be some equity in that aspect. But I think, you know, truthfully, the idea of metering is that people that live 5 minutes away from their work probably shouldn't be using the freeway, that from kind of just an overall kind of best use of the system, that them getting off and on the freeway was not really the intention of the freeway. And that so that there is that reality that maybe isn't the best use of the system that way.
All right. So Rich Hedges, thank you.
I just want to say that I really agree with Steve. There's some things the federal government does better than the state, some things the state do better than the counties, and there's some things that MTC does better than the individual governmental entities, and that's maintaining the roads and coordinating the transportation service. And I understand the struggle for for funding at the local community because there's shortage of funds everywhere. God knows we're already fighting over money that doesn't exist in cap and trade. So what I would say is that just in real life examples of why it's important to have one pot for this money is that recently I had to replace a tire and get my front end lined up. And that did not happen near my house. That happened out on 205, right about where 205 leaves 580, with that miserably constructed area out there where no matter how hard you try, you couldn't miss all the holes. And so that affected me directly no matter where the funds came back to. And when we can fix those kind of things, it's important to have one entity that can look at that and make sure that gets done. And the federal highway system was built with basically free money for most of the local entities, and that's no longer free, nor is there enough money even in the system to maintain it, so we have to find the money somewhere. And there's just some things that MTC will be better at, and that's part of it. Thank you.
Right. And I know we're running short on time here, so I'll just take the liberty of asking one question, and that relates to the actively managing of variable speed limits, which is really attractive to me from a public health perspective, frankly. But I know one of the most cost-effective GHG reduction strategies from Plan Bay Area was the reduction of the overall freeway speed. So, sorry, Steve's laughing at me, but I'm wondering if CHP is a barrier to implementation of this, and I'm curious about that.
Well, you remember how popular that idea proved, too.
Yes, absolutely.
I mean, half the places we went, they said, if you can get me going 60 miles an hour, you're my hero, you know? I do think the Highway Patrol, just as we and Caltrans have some work to do, also has some work to do. You know, as Melanie said, they've been giving us a bit of a hard time about the call boxes, and I think a little bit too hard a time because, you know, they're in most cases, they really just outlive their usefulness. But they're used to them, and they like them, and they're a lifeline. And so, look, I just think we all need to get into a different kind of a mindset on that. Melanie, I don't know if you mentioned, because I came in before, after you started your presentation, but the I-80 project, why don't you just give us a 30-second drill on that? Because that's coming soon, isn't it?
Yes, it is. So on the corridor from basically Carquinez down to the Bay Bridge, you may have, if you live along that corridor, you may see there's work going on in the roadway now, and there are signs that are being put out that say integrated corridor management. So basically, that is really taking all these technologies and trying to knit them together to get bigger bang for the buck. So I talked about the next generation of ramp metering being adaptive ramp meters. So they are installing adaptive ramp meters along that corridor. They also are going to have the gantries over the freeways where they will have this lane by lane management. They that's not without its controversy. I would say that it certainly some are concerned about its kind of obstruction of a view corridor and things like that. But certainly from a freeway management perspective, they are doing something pretty innovative there. The variable speed is another one of the features that they'll be putting in there. And the idea really is that, you know, it's a long corridor, it's very congested, and it's very volatile. So there's an accident on Ashby, they'll start modifying the speeds upstream of that to basically to even out the flow more. So it has huge environmental benefits as well as huge safety benefits. So that'll be the first corridor in our region that will be voluntary. So it's not enforceable by CHP, but it will be variable speed limits. So that is, I think, a really important thing. Steve talked about experimenting. I think this is a really important experiment that we will learn a lot from. Other countries have been pretty successful in variable speeds. I think it's something that's been less used in the United States, and I think that we're only kind of catching up now on this particular feature.
And even if it's not enforceable, will sort of enforcement be part of one of the performance metrics for that pilot?
I don't know the answer to that.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much. So now I think we're ready to move on to item 6, which is the disadvantaged business enterprise and small business enterprise entitled 6 update from Denise Rodriguez. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Good afternoon, Denise Rodriguez, Contract Compliance Manager here at MTC. I'm just going to give you a brief update on MTC's disadvantaged business enterprise and Title VI activities. First thing I want to talk about is MTC's DBE triennial submittal to the Federal Transit Administration. As previously reported to this committee, MTC adopted FHWA or Caltrans DBE program back in 2009. But as a recipient of FTA funds as well, we are required to submit a triennial submittal to the Federal Transit Administration on upcoming contract opportunities and the goals or race-conscious efforts related to those contracts, as well as race-neutral efforts that we're going to make along with the funding that comes from the federal government. What those terms mean, race conscious and race neutral, basically are race conscious are when goals are applied to contracts, and race neutral are those efforts we make to do outreach and try to organically or naturally achieve SBE and DBE participation on our contracts. So that report was submitted in the end of July of last year and was approved by the FTA in August of 2013. That report is not included in your package. It was previously submitted to you, but it is available online, and the link is in the committee memo. I mentioned race-neutral efforts are those ways to naturally obtain DBE and SBE participation, and what MTC does, along with other transit agencies in the region, we've developed a group called the Business Outreach Committee, and what you see attached in Attachment A is a summary of some newsletters that we issue. Newsletters are issued quarterly, and that has information on upcoming contracting events or upcoming contracting opportunities as well, and as well as technical assistance workshops that we offer that we put together on a quarterly basis. Basically, by pooling our resources, we feel that we're providing a better service to the DBE and SBE community because they're able to take just a smaller time out of their day or work week and then actually get information from 14 transit agencies as opposed to trying to go to 14 different events. So that information, again, is in Attachment A. One thing I do want to mention is we did have an event this past Monday. It was very successful. I'd say we had about 150 people. It was at SFMTA. And in the committee memo, we talk about the upcoming CalMentor event, and that was previously scheduled for April 24th, and that has been rescheduled for May 5th. And so there are revised flyers, because I just found out about this this week, so I apologize for this late notice, but there's the flyer is on the table there. There's enough for everyone here, and it's also posted on the MTC website. I'm going to move on now to Title VI and our activities there. As a recipient of federal funds, we also pass through funds to sub-recipients. And one of our requirements as the pass-through entity is to monitor those sub-recipients to ensure that they are abiding by Title VI and have Title VI plans and are giving access to those with limited English proficiency. So what we do with the JARCA New Freedom Program is actively monitor our subrecipients there, and we have received Title VI programs from everyone in that program. If there are problems with some of the Title VI plans that we've received and there have been some minor problems, we're working with those entities to correct those. And what we also do on an annual basis, because funding is given out for multiple years, we check in with them on an annual basis. They've turn in FTA certs and assurances on an annual basis, and also reassert their Title VI plans to us. So we're trying to actively monitor them. And then on an ad hoc basis, we'll start to do site visits as we can. Additionally, FTA's requires MTC to submit a triennial Title VI report based on it's basically a memorialization of activities that we've undertaken. Our last report was due and was submitted in October of 2010. Our next report is due in October of this year. So staff is working to draft that document right now. And again, that's going to just really summarize all of our Title VI activities since our last report, which was submitted in 2010. That report will be submitted to this committee as an informational item. It will also go to our commission for approval. We're also, we revised our complaint form. One of the things that we're required to do for those with limited English proficiency is to provide translations. And MTC adopted a language assistance plan almost a year ago now, in May of last year. And primarily we translate into Spanish and Chinese, or those Mandarin and Cantonese, I believe. But for all languages where there are over 1,000 people or more than 5% in the region, we're also required to have a statement on our Title VI complaint form that provides information in those languages that meet that criteria. So we updated our Title VI complaint form. So it went from 2 pages to, I think it's 5 pages now, because you can imagine in our region there are a lot of languages that meet that criteria of 1,000 or 5%. But this way, at a minimum, they have a way to understand how to get the complaint form translated into their own language. So that, again, is available online. And then also staff is going to, we issued, I believe it was in early 2011, a Title VI staff training to all of MTC staff and everyone, regardless of whether or not they regularly come into, whether they deal with the public on a regular basis or not. So we'll be reissuing that in probably next month is when we plan to, for all staff again. And then all new staff, when they are onboarded, will be receiving that training. The Clipper activities, I want to point out, that's Attachment B, attached to the memo. And there's a Clipper report on activities undertaken and really outreach to some retail outlets and a lot of marketing as well to low-income and, again, limited English proficient persons. Clipper is undertaking quite an outreach of activities, and they've just started in March of this month, March last month, and it'll go through June of this year. So the report here just has some activities to date, but of course there'll be much and many more, hopefully, milestones and achievements made with that marketing that they're undertaking. And then the last thing I want to mention is that staff takes the lead with what is called the Title VI Working Group. And we're having a call tomorrow for those that are located in the region. It's actually a nationwide working group of Title VI professionals from transit agencies throughout the country. And for those in the region, they'll be coming here. And it's really a way, because a lot of agencies have limited staff, and it's a way to share best practices, share documentations, learn from one another, to avoid mistakes, and really go about lessons learned. And I think it's a really beneficial tool. I find it really beneficial. I found out about the FTA triennial workshop that I didn't know about just while I was putting together the agenda. So with that, I'll ask you if you have any questions.
I'm seeing Will and then Chris.
I have a question on your Title VI program. What county has it been most successful with reaching out to the people, and they understand what we're trying to present to them?
Well, that's a difficult question to answer, because we're a regional entity, and Title VI, I like to think of it as sort of a web that is entangled in everything we do. I think it probably has the largest impact in our customer-oriented services. So things like Clipper and the marketing outreach there to those with limited English proficiency or those in low-income areas, to make sure that the retail outlets where they can obtain Clipper cards are available to them. I would say that's probably where we've gotten had the biggest impact. But even though Fast Track, let's say, doesn't receive federal funds, the language lines for that customer service center are obviously really beneficial to help those with limited English proficiency as well. But that said, those are our customer-oriented services. There's the OBAG, which Craig is going to talk about a little bit later. I think that our Title VI activities related to planning and our public participation in those areas are really significant as well.
Right. I tend to agree with you. Your Clipper program has reached out to most of the 9 Bay Area counties, and they tend to understand how to use it. It's just a matter of sometimes when we present some of the MTC programs, we have all these public meetings they still look as puzzled as when they came in the door because they don't understand overall what's happening. So we may have to do more outreach or more in-depth outreach to them.
Yeah, we adopted or revised our public participation plan in 2010, and we'll be revising it again. I believe we'll probably start the revision, and there'll be a public comment period and all of that. I think we're planning to do that over within the next year or so. And one of the things in our current plan is definitely working with community-based organizations or CBOs to really help them access the community, because a lot of what we do here, I mean, sometimes, I'll be frank, I still get lost in, you know, how the funding works. And so helping us work with the CBOs, they help us put that into layman terms, and then also to translate it for those with limited English proficiency. So I will take that note from you, and that's welcome feedback. Thank you.
Chris?
Thank you. On your business outreach committee, I don't see the Smart Rail District listed, and I hope that you can try to get them involved in the future.
We are always looking for new members and trying to pass on information, so thank you for that reminder.
Thanks. They've got a lot of construction going on now, and I'm sure that they could use some help.
Thank you. I just had one observation about a Clipper card sale that I and I don't know how we fixed this, but it was somebody with no English trying to figure out how to purchase a Clipper card from somebody who spoke no Spanish. And so the transaction was, to say the least, very awkward, and I wasn't sure. Money exchanged hands. The card went out the door, but I still wasn't sure at the end whether the person actually leaving who had paid for something actually had a good understanding, because there was just this puzzled look on her face as she left. So materials, are those supplied to the vendors that are in multiple languages, or is there a way for them in like a specific area to request materials?
Yes, there definitely is a way for them to request materials, and Clipper materials are regularly translated not only into Spanish and Chinese but to other languages as well. Where can I ask you, Randy, where this was
at? It was at a Walgreens in San Jose.
Well, no, that's because Walgreens is one of the major...
That's one of your big ones.
Yeah.
And I was just kind of surprised to see this, and I had a chat with the manager on the floor, but, you know, that was like, I know I'm not talking to anybody with any juice there. So I just want, you know, and to be honest, wasn't going to follow up on it. So, and my other question is there that I can have an agency or a nonprofit contact you for like a stack of that material and just bundle it for them, just the information material?
Definitely.
Okay.
And I will work with Clipper staff and to find out what information that they give to Walgreens and the other retail outlets that issue Clipper cards so that I can answer that question.
Yeah,
I'll get that answer for you.
I think what happens is you talk to people on a regional level, but it's the person that's standing there at the cash register that's making $8 an hour. No, San Jose, $10 and 10 cents an hour. Woo-hoo. That is conducting the transaction that has no control over whatever they have there. So just being able to check back in regionally with them and say, hey, if your stores need this, let us know, because it's a store that does a high volume, I think. Thanks.
Okay. Any other questions? All
right. Seeing none, I think that's great. Thank you, Denise. So item 7 is an update on the One Bay Area grant from Craig Goldblatt.
Hi, thank you for having me. I'm Craig. Work with the programming and allocations group, and we've had One Bay Area grant since May 2012 when the commission adopted it. So we wanted to look at the outcomes. What are the kinds of projects and the results that we got out of this brand new program? It's a sort of evaluation. I would say it's more looking at the administrative, from an administrative point of view, because we really don't have the results of the projects that are only now beginning to head toward construction in terms of how they're going to contribute to transportation as well as the priority development areas, which was a focus of this program. Excuse me, I want to go back there. So I wanted to talk a little bit about some of the objectives of the One Bay Area Grant Program. The One Bay Area Grant Program in many ways finds its beginnings with SB 375, where we want to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. And one way to deliver on that mandate is to look at how we might be able to use house funding in the region to reach those objectives. So this is a new paradigm that we have started using at MTC through this program, where we basically are going to provide, we do provide awards indirectly through this program for jurisdictions that accept and deliver housing. And there's a priority development area interface, as you'll see later on, but also we provide incentives and targets to ensure that a large part of this funding goes into the priority development areas, which is a key building block of the SCS strategy. Also, the program provides even more local decision-making than previous cycles of federal funding, and we're also looking at providing a lot more flexibility among the different types of transportation projects that could be funded compared to how we did it in the past. So we instituted a new way of distributing funds to the region to pick projects. In the past, we had more or less separate pots of funding that were attached to different transportation needs. For example, we had a local streets and roads rehab program, and the commission adopted a certain amount for that pot. And there was a regional bicycle and pedestrian program, and the commission assigned a bit of funding for that pot. But now we put all the money together, and we distributed through this formula. 50% of it is based on the population of the counties in jurisdictions, and the other 50% is our new model where we're looking at housing, and we're looking at RENA, looking forward, and those are our housing commitments that jurisdictions are willing to take moving forward. We also look at housing production, given that the commission was interested in looking at actually what was delivered versus, from a policy point of view, what jurisdictions are willing to accept. And we also had a little twist to the formula as well, where we wanted to give rewards for accepting and producing units for low-income housing categories. So there's more flexibility. As I mentioned before, we don't have silos like we did, which we call silos, in the previous cycle. The various types of projects that would be eligible to accept the funding are over to the right. These aren't brand new programs over the last cycle, except for the priority conservation area pot or category. But the new innovation is that a CMA could pick from any one of these pots before they had certain limits. The other thing I wanted to talk about quickly was that the congestion management agencies is the entity that is assigned to making the choices within a county, even though the formula goes down to the jurisdiction level. So we roll up all the funding and then we give it to the congestion management agencies, and they're not required to be sure that every jurisdiction gets the amount where they've contributed to the formula. And you can see here as well that there is a significant increase of funding over the last cycle that we've made available to the counties. And the biggest winners tend to be urban counties that are able and willing to accept far more housing in priority development area type environments. We looked at what kind of projects were picked by the congestion management agencies, given the independence and flexibility we gave them. There's an appendix in the report that lists all the projects by county, so you can see which jurisdictions receive funds, as well as what the project types are. Looking at those projects, they are significantly larger compared to the last cycle, over 50%. And the TLC share in this program is 40%, which was the largest piece of the pie. If you put that together with the Safe Route to School and the bike ped categories, in terms of active transportation, that is over 60% of OBAG going to active transportation. And one of the reasons for this was that there were certainly color of funding eligibility limitations, while we have a lot of flexibility in this program, one of the limitations was that surface transportation program funds and CMAQ, the CMAQ funds had their limitations. STP was the only fund source that could be used for rehab projects, and that went down from the last cycle where we had 70% available. And during the One Bay Area grant program period, we only had 50%. So that that did bring down the share of surface of local streets and roads rehab projects. One success of the program was that we, in addition to having much larger projects, we also had ones of much greater complexity that were more multimodal, because we allowed CMAs and city applicants to mix and match categories when they applied for a project. And these are just an example of some of the largest projects that did come out of the One Bay Area grant program, such as San Francisco's Masonic Avenue Complete Streets. Just down the street, the Oakland's Lakeside Complete Streets and Road Diet, you know, completing more of the work around Lake Merritt, Fremont City Center multimodal improvements near the BART station, which also looks at making their downtown work better. A significant project in downtown Berkeley involving both the BART stations and making some fix on Shattuck Avenue in terms of making the whole area function better. And then we had a project such as the Santa Clara County Capital Expressway traffic and ITS project, another approach to traffic management coupled with bicycle and pedestrian improvements. So as part of the policy of the One Bay Area grant program, there were requirements to ensure that a significant amount of the funds went to support priority development areas. So there were investment targets in the program. The North Bay counties, because they were more rural in nature and had fewer priority development areas, had a 50% target that they had to reach. The remaining counties had a higher target of 70%, and as you can see, all the counties did exceed their targets. We also provided some flexibility on what it means to be, support a PDA through their investments, and each board had to adopt their own definition of what it meant to have proximate access to a PDA, so we provided some flexibility so they didn't have to be totally within a PDA. And we also have maps that are in your pack in the report as well, and they're quite nice to look at in terms of comparing the priority development area locations and the projects, so you can see quite nicely, how the investments aligned with the priority development areas. A bit further analysis looking at Cycle 1 versus One Bay Area grants. While there were some differences in the percentages among the categories, all categories did receive more funding under One Bay Area grants. The percent emphasis, though, shifted among the program types. The TLC bike ped categories increased more relative to the local streets and roads programs for some of the reasons I mentioned, that based on eligibility of federal funds for rehab and some of the PDA investment target minimums might not, where they had to channel projects might not have aligned well with where some of the rehab needs were. One of the focuses, while not a requirement at the project level, was complete streets. And I think this is a thread that goes through a number of our programs at MTC. 59% of the projects did involve a complete street focus. And part of that was we had, as you saw from the one of the previous slides, that we had a very strong TLC bike ped percentage share of the program. So we also wanted to take a look to see if one of the stated objectives of OBAG, which was to reward jurisdictions that accept and deliver on more housing, whether they received more funding. So we looked at the top 16 jurisdictions with the highest housing unit growth projected between 2010 and 2040. And as shown in the summary table in aggregate across 16 jurisdictions, the level of investment aligns fairly well with the formula generations of 50% versus 56%. And further, the 16 jurisdictions saw a small increase in the investment share over the prior cycle at 50% versus 47%. We then focused further and looked at the three largest jurisdictions with the most housing growth, and those would be San Jose, San Francisco, and Oakland, as shown in this summary table. For the three largest cities, there doesn't appear to be a direct link between the OBAG generation formula and the investment decisions. As you see, two jurisdictions received a higher or equivalent grant share, and one received a lower share. This pattern was similar for other large cities, and this suggests that project selection was based on other factors than housing share, such as the PDA requirements we talked about. For this cycle, where there were ready-to-go projects, some counties that had local streets and roads rehabilitation funds that were owed to jurisdictions that had not received their full shares in cycle one, and other project-specific issues as well. But that being said, San Jose, San Francisco, and Oakland all received a larger share of funding in one Bay Area grant as compared to cycle one. There were local policy requirements as well as some of the funding requirements we talked about. One of them was a complete streets requirement, where we required that a jurisdiction receiving one Bay Area grant funds met either one of two ways conditions. One would be that they either have a general plan or they're planning on amending their general plan to comply with the Complete Streets Act of 2008, or they could choose to have their board adopt a complete street resolution that we worked with together along with the Active Transportation Committee about what elements had to be in that resolution. And you can see the breakdown. For about 40% met the General Plan Complete Street Act. Very few, as a result of this, went out and actually made a change to their general plan. The majority of these already had language in their plan that met the requirements of the Office of Planning and Research that are pretty flexible. There is a deadline in the current One Bay Area grant policies that all jurisdictions meet the Complete Street Act path, but we have heard from various committees that they feel that this might be too high of a bar and it might not be necessary given how rigorous their resolutions are, and that's something that we're going to be discussing further for the next cycle. Another local policy requirement was to have a housing element of a general plan certified by HCD prior to being able to receive OBAG funds. And this is coupled together with the RENA requirements. To meet RENA, jurisdictions have to have general plans and zoning that show that they can accommodate the housing. I'm in RENA. When we adopted One Bay Area Grant, 28 jurisdictions were out of compliance. And then January 31st, 2014, 27 met the requirement. And so we only had one city that did not meet the requirement, and that was the city of Albany. So that was a success. There were several cities that hadn't met this requirement for like two or three RENA cycles prior to One Bay Area Grant. And then in conclusion, there were requirements that the congestion management agencies needed to fulfill. One was that they needed to prepare priority development area investment and growth strategies. These carried out a number of things. One area was that they need to coordinate what kind of transportation investments would be called for to meet the needs of their priority development areas. There is some timing issues with respect to that, because when they had to select the projects for the cycle, in many cases they were at the same time putting together their growth investment strategy. But there's been a lot of work that a lot of CMAs have been carrying on in this area that they've been folding in, so that did inform to a certain degree the projects that were selected. We expect a much stronger link for the next round of One Bay Area Grant. And then the other requirement was that we have a public outreach that meets Title VI, as Denise outlined, as well as that there be everyone was really, and all the players knew about the competitive process and were able to apply for projects. There was a very robust public outreach program in each CMA. They varied, and we're going to continue to monitor that and encourage even more documentation than we received for the first cycle. So that concludes my presentation, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
I will start off with Sandy.
I actually have a lot of questions. I was a little confused by some of the slides, so I hope you'll indulge me. So I wanted to go back to the slide 3 around the original generation formula. So I wasn't clear. So was this the formula that was used to determine how much of the OBAG funds in general would go to each county? So it was these formulas were looked at for the county as a whole, or was each CMA supposed to also use this formula in the decision-making process for the grants that it gave out in its county? That's my first question, because I had been under the impression it was the latter, but it seems like it might have been just the former.
Well, the $320 million went through this formula. We looked at every city. We did it regionally in terms of what their share was for these various factors, and then we rolled it up and we got an amount for each county geographic area, and that we gave to the congestion management agencies. We delegated to them, and they conducted a solicitation and worked with all the stakeholders to pick projects subject to the rules of this program. But they did not have to follow, like the Oakland didn't, Alameda didn't, CMA did not have to say, well, Oakland, according to this formula, you in our county, you receive 50% of the funds, so we're going to have to give you 50% of the money. It was up to their board to decide based on whatever the needs were, and as well as meeting things like PDA targets, what projects they would select.
So my second question was if you could just quickly go over what the requirements were for the CMAs, because you refer to them, but I was never clear on what were all the things that were actually required.
I think one good place to start, and I'll mention some of the things, is on our webpage. There is like a 4-page summary of the overall One Bay Area Grant program with all the requirements. So that might pull it together, because I didn't really go over everything in detail. But
because it's been a while since we've talked about this, so I was having a hard time remembering what was, you know, to have a report card, it's good to remember what you're actually supposed to be measuring against. And so it seems like what was required was the PDA investment and growth strategy, a public outreach plan of some sort. The certification of either the something to show that they're going to comply with complete streets, either through general plan or through some kind of resolution, and the meeting the RENA
HCD
certification. So those were the things, the four things that were required?
Those were required, as well as they had to meet their PDA targets and with their choices of projects where One Bay Area grant funds were going to go to.
So how did the housing stuff fit in? Because you said that there didn't seem to be as much of a link between the how was that required or not required? I wasn't clear about that.
There are parts of the growth investment strategy where they're going to have to the CMAs are going to have to monitor how affordable housing policies and housing as we go forward. But there are certainly going to be rewards when we have subsequent cycles of this based on the commission's pleasure on whether this formula might be jiggered with a little bit. But the rewards are more at the upfront right now when we distribute the funds to the county with respect to housing. There are really no housing requirements after we distribute the funds to the CMA for project selection. But in the investment and growth strategy, they need to be looking at what is happening in PDAs with respect to housing, more on a policy level. But I don't think housing doesn't come in after we directly.
Well, Craig, let me supplement with just two points. One is we had a pretty robust debate about who the decision maker ought to be, right? Most of this money started with MTC being the decision maker. And the basic offer here was that we would delegate that to the local level. We would get some policy reform. They would get some flexibility. Now, who do you give it to? Do you give it to a county-level organization or individual jurisdictions? And the commission decided to land on the county-level one, because we really didn't feel we were in the best position to decide that this 101 jurisdictions were the right folks to work with. The other place I think where housing really manifests itself is in the formula itself. And the way this formula works, half the money is apportioned by housing, which is revolutionary in a transportation funding program. You never look at housing. And half of that housing half is looking backward at how much housing you built, actually built. And half of it's looking forward in RENA, how much you're promising to build. And as time goes on, even if we don't change this formula at all, your county's going to be rewarded with more money the more housing you build. And my own view is that over time, I think we ought to weight the formula more heavily toward what you've actually produced, so that you're actually rewarded for production, not for promises. But we decided to start with sort of a havesy-havesy approach to strike a happy medium. So I think the link with housing is primarily in the formula itself. And we're counting on that working as a proper incentive. Now, as Craig said, if we could double this program or triple or quadruple it, you know, it's obviously a larger carrot. And the bigger the carrot we can make, I think the more we're going to see some change. But the fact that we had 28 places that were basically blowing off the housing needs process, and now we're down to one that I think by now might even have been approved, that's also a sea change. And it shows you the power of the purse and how much this money is spoken already.
Thanks, Steve. I have one final question. It's around slides 11 and 12. I was confused about these slides, the ones about the link between funding and housing. If you could walk me through what these actually mean, I'd really appreciate it.
All right. What we did is we looked at, even though the formula, as you know, is not totally based on housing projections in the future, we were looking at past production and there's population. We just wanted to get a sense of looking at jurisdictions that had a lot of where they were accommodating and accepting a lot of the housing, how they were doing in terms of the funding they received. So we looked at what percentage regionally of, you know, how much housing they received in percentage terms, and then we looked at what percentage of One Bay Area grant funds they received. And the hope was that the more housing that they're going to be providing, they should be getting that much percentage in OBAC funding or more.
Yeah, what we didn't want to see is the high producers getting hosed in the project process, right? We wanted them to look pretty good. And if you go to the next slide, Craig, I mean, this is one where, you know, San Francisco is an outlier, right, because the city equals the county. So in the case of Oakland, they got more than they generated by formula. And in fact, we heard about that from some folks from other jurisdictions in Alameda County. In San Jose and Santa Clara, the situation's reversed, where if you're San Jose, you might want to make the case next time that, hey, guys, we were a little light last time because we generated a lot of revenue for the county by virtue of our housing numbers, so we think we ought to get more. So that's why we thought that tension between the cities within the county and a countywide organization was the best place to have that conversation or debate or dispute, rather than having it here with 101 cities.
Thanks. Randy and then Rich.
Thank you. Just the housing numbers that you were just discussing, I think that for San Jose in particular, with a jobs housing imbalance, we need to long-term look at that it doesn't do San Jose any good to generate housing without generating jobs. So when we're looking at that, I'd like to see some type of balancing act going on, because rewarding San Jose for producing housing is a bad thing. It doesn't generate any tax money for us to actually run the city after that. So I don't want us to keep encouraging bad behavior there. We're already in enough trouble with that. The one thing that I did want to point out was that the money that goes towards, for instance, safe routes to schools rewards new development in PDA areas, but doesn't necessarily address the existing deficiencies for safe routes to schools and safe routes to transit. And again, it's kind of rewarding a developer for doing something that they should be doing anyway, or a jurisdiction for doing something that they should be doing anyway. So I want to make sure that somehow we're able to tie in existing deficiencies with, for instance, around the new BART station in San Jose. Great new plan coming along. There's a great connection within this nodule of development around the BART station, but that's not necessarily connecting to the next piece down the line. So I want to make sure that we have the ability to address that down the line. My third thing is a question, and that was about the, I think you called it robust outreach that was done by the CMAs. And I'm not sure what that means in my case, because I didn't see any evidence of robust outreach. So is there a way of locating the information as to how they did outreach or who they reached out to, or...
Well, they have some of that this information on their website, and I think our public information staff, we had to kind of go out and gather a little bit of that information. It wasn't quite as smooth this cycle in terms of getting it from them, but we did adopt as part of One Bay Area Grant things, various requirements that they needed to carry out, which we found that they didn't meet those requirements. So there were various levels of what they did, but VTA actually has quite a large spreadsheet showing a lot of different things that they worked on.
So I will just point out, I'm a planning geek, and the city pushes information to me on a almost daily basis on projects. So for me, who has all my connections with VTA and my connections with the city, to not know of any of this outreach tells me there's a disconnect somewhere. So VTA's version of robust outreach and actually reaching out to the at least a million people in my city has some tweaking to do. So I'd like to see us kind of standardize what we consider outreach and what the target is for that. I mean, if they're considering reaching out by going through other agencies, then that's not going to work very well. If they're actually reaching out to the public and posting a notification or expecting me to go read their website every day to see what's new, that's not particularly effective either. So I just want to make sure that when we say robust, we have an idea of what robust means.
Thanks. Rich?
Thank you. I remember the debate clearly, especially over slide 3, and I remember being very concerned about the peninsula because we had entitled so much housing, but 2008 hit, and 2,000 units that were about ready to be built evaporated from the scene as far as willingness to build them. So that's all turned around now, and hopefully you're going to see us on the production side of it, getting higher numbers on the board. About 1,100 of them are being built now. Someone sitting at this table, who's my personal hero, is breaking ground for 599, 60 of which will be very, very low-income housing. And quite frankly, looking back at it now, I like this formula a lot better than I did in 2008. having said that, I just want to give you one example, and I never pass up a chance to have on the street real-life examples of how dear the spillover-rate housing is. I'm on a nonprofit housing board, and I was at Home Depot soliciting a grant to help us with our efforts. And the woman I was sent to that controls which grants the management sees with Home Depot found out what I was doing and said, I have a Section 8 grant for a three-bedroom apartment, and I can't find anybody that will accept it. She's driving an hour a day each way to get to work, and she's living in an area that she fears for her children. She got three kids. So I don't know how we're ever going to solve this, but we can never stop trying. And the other side of that is, as a guy who does collective bargaining, or did for many, many years, I understand the sweet spot between killing the goose that provides the jobs and builds the buildings and finding enough money to do what you need to do socially. So we have to have a balance with everything we do, and I think, long story short, I think you've reached the balance with this formula, and I like it.
Thanks, Rich. I am going to pass along one question from Carlos Castellanos, who had to leave a bit early, and that is he noticed on slide 13, for example, zero of the Alameda County jurisdictions had complied with the complete streets requirement vis-a-vis their general plan and used a resolution instead. So what are you doing? What will MTC be doing in the next round? I think the date was pushed out to June 2015.
I think January 31st, 2015.
Okay. So what's the plan for helping people with the circulation elements?
I think we need to discuss that date further because there already are a number of our partners and commissioners have expressed some concern to look at that date with what's involved in doing a general plan update. And then the other fact they pointed out is that these resolutions in many ways can have a lot more teeth than having a general plan transportation that have broad statements about complete streets. So I think that's something we're going to talk about further this fall. I think the reason for the preponderance, I should say, total unanimity of resolutions in Alameda County is their measure program requires a complete street resolution in order to be eligible for measure funding.
And Carolyn, I will come to you in just one moment. So sorry. I had a couple of other questions, too, in terms of the outreach. I would just really second Randy's comments. And I'm glad that it's part of the council's work plan to really develop some of that engagement and outreach. And I know it was something that Ann cited early on the formation of OBAG was that we can't dial down too much on this instruction yet, but I think the guidance has got to be there. I know from in my county, the public comment form that you cited as being nice and simple, that might be one good example, but the outreach did not go beyond their regular stakeholder outreach for like putting together projects. And one of the things I would just like to emphasize is that Plan Bay Area is fundamentally different from the previous simple county transportation plans. We're talking about really achieving different goals than stapling together some projects. And I think the CMAs need our help and the commission's help to say, here is what we really mean, to go to your community members, to your residents, not to your operators and other agencies. And I would really like to see them held accountable in the next round.
You know, can I mention two things? One is on Friday, we're actually bringing an item to our planning committee updating our guidelines on the countywide transportation plans. And, you know, to be fair, we just haven't done it often enough. And so these are several years old. And the planning world has changed. So that's, I think, going to be one opportunity for all of you, not only as a group, but as individual advocates in these counties to be digging in. I think the second thing, and you know, I'd rather we not be sort of in the middle of an experience that Randy has, that she's seen it with her own eyes. So, like, who are you going to believe, me or your own lying eyes? I'm wondering whether we ought to try to get maybe a group of the planning directors from the CMAs to come to one of your meetings, and you can talk to each other face to face and say, look, what you're doing ain't good enough, and here's what we mean by good enough. I think that might be a good exchange to have.
That would be great. And seeing the memo that's coming to the planning committee on Friday, I believe, it seemed like the recommendations that those directors were going to develop were going to come to us after the fact. I would really love to have that conversation with them before that those recos are developed.
Well, I'm looking straight at Pam, so I'm sure she can make that happen.
Sorry, Carolyn, for going on for a bit. Thank you.
Thanks. I just had a quick question, really. On slide 10, there the report on Complete Streets Project Focus, and I'm looking at Sonoma because that's where I'm from, and it says Complete Streets elements that were included in 9 projects, I think. There was a total of 16 projects.
Yes.
So my question is that, are those projects that came before the county only, or were those projects, you know, within the county? Into the cities, or was it just under the county?
That was a total group of projects from all jurisdictions in Sonoma County that was approved by the Congestion Management Agency, SCTA.
So as far as the Complete Streets ordinances that were done, was that just a county ordinance?
This slide isn't so much about the resolution.
Well, this is a separate question. The ordinances that were also included here, was that just county, under the county jurisdiction, or was that supposed to be applied to the cities as
every jurisdiction receiving OBEC, cities and the county, had to meet that requirement.
Okay. And I just wanted to clarify, and just a comment, the Complete Streets concept is one of my favorite concepts in terms of planning, and so I you know, love that this is tied to this, and also in terms of housing, that housing is tied to it, as long as it's very low income and low income housing, and of course within the county itself, also where that housing is going to be located. That would be a concern of mine. So thank you.
All right. I don't see any more questions at this point. Craig, thanks for coming in. I know there's a lot of information to present in a short time. Thank you. And with that, I think we will, in the short time we have left, move on to Pam's staff liaison report.
Well, hopefully I can hit the highlights in the next 30 seconds. Just a reminder, since your meeting is after Bike to Work Day in May, that Bike to Work Day is coming up on May 8th. Some of you may know, there are a lot of activities that happen during the month of May, not just on May 8th, but surrounding Bike to Work Month. And you can find out about all of that information on the link that we've provided, youcanbikethere.com, including ways to sign up for the team bike challenge and the company bike challenge and all of those great bike events that are happening in May. So Bike to Work Day, May 8th, reminder. And also at the end of my staff report, you'll see a copy of the final work plan for the next year that Kathleen presented to the commission last month. Just wanted you to have a copy of that. And also just reminding you that the first item we will be tackling on that, in the work plan we discussed having brainstorming sessions over the next year. So we're going to be changing things up from time to time in how we do business as a committee. And your first meeting doing that will be next month. And talking about this idea of education and outreach that was brought up by several people here today. So we want to give you a chance to give input into how MTC does outreach, possibly look at creating some toolkits in the future. But we want to start with a brainstorming session next month. So in preparation for that, I'm reminding you again, and I've put the links in here in my report, that you have some homework to do a little bit of reading on the public outreach participation for Plan Bay Area, the report there. Also, the legacy of leadership pamphlet that we created before the last Plan Bay Area round. That was the very first thing that we created for people to see. And then also our public participation plan. So there's three links there in your report, and I will be emailing those to you again this week to remind you yet again to get started reading so that we can have a great discussion when we get together next month. And finally, I just wanted to mention, for those of you who might not be aware, that our Deputy Executive Director is now our former Deputy Executive Director. Ann Flemmer retired just this last Friday, so you will not be seeing her at the tables anymore. But stay tuned, and Steve was here today, and we enjoyed that. So that's all I have.
All right. Thank you, Pam. And Alan, I think, and then Rich, looks like you're the first two members with new business.
I'd like to, because I don't see it in the work plan, I'd like to talk again about that we need to, and it would be good for us to talk to the Air Quality Board now in relationship to the legal suit and what they plan on doing after the suit. As far as the effect of their rules on priority development areas, because their rules basically stop priority development areas as they now stand. And if they happen to win the case, we're going to have to fight them every time we want to build a substantial project over 80 units in any priority development area. I might be off in my number, but I'm looking at what some people have told me on that, and I think it's important we get them in and talk to them before they come up with a hard rule next time, because they're supposedly our partners. I also want to thank the MTC because they paid for half of the smart street outside of my project. I paid for the other half, but they paid for half.
Resource sharing is always key. Rich.
Okay, just a short report, but hopefully short. But I also, these will be a couple suggestions on possibly people that could do some education of us in the future. I went on a tour with Universal Paragon, who's building most of Mission Bay, and also a Brisbane project that will be well in excess of 100 acres. They would like to build 4,000 units of housing. Brisbane now has about 312 rooftops, and they don't want it. And the problem is that other communities are stepping up to share the workforce housing, and this is going to create huge numbers of jobs. And the sad thing is the 3rd Street Rail ends there, and it's going into the Caltrain station, and with electrification, it'll be about 4 trains an hour stopping there. And it really needs to have housing. But it's a wonderful project. It's an alternative site for the Golden State Warriors Stadium if it doesn't go on the Embarcadero. I'd rather see more productive stuff there, but some people think sports are productive. As a parallel, which has already been approved, in October, the 49ers stadium is coming down, and just part of this development will be 6,000 units of housing. Lennar is doing it, just like they're doing other projects in and around San Francisco. And so I would like to have Universal Paragon at some time come here. I've seen them in other presentations. It's not that long, and you get a really good view of what's happening very near and around San Francisco that's really going to build the economy, and it's also going to be, if it's done right, provide a lot of workforce housing. Something a lot less sexy. I had a meeting at the city level with the city manager and some of the planning commissioners with an individual from Canada that runs a company that's building heating and cooling systems. Now, try not to sort of lose your lunch over this, but they use sewage to do it. And I looked at the system, and knowing as an old guy the way we heated multiple structures where I came from in the urban area through the power and light plant and steam, this will work. And there's almost no hydrocarbons from it. And it's a novel system. I'm not going to take too long to go into it, but I understand it because I'm an old pipe fitter. And they're doing it on 30,000 condominium units in British Columbia, and those are being built primarily for immigrants. So the other issue is part of that tour was Bay Meadows. We had hoped, it's been discussed here, that when you build transit and development, you get 25% using transit for work. The other savings are in services. The people that have already moved in there are reporting there's over 50% of the people every morning taking the train. It's a real win-win. And guess what? There's fencing now that blocks the path. They have to go out of their way to get to the train. When everything's done there, it'll be a short shot, and I think we're going to have upwards of 75% of the people, because they're all techies, and they make good money because they're not cheap.
Transit-oriented development is self-selecting for people that want transit, and a lot of people forget that.
So I'll just sum up by saying I took a lot of stuff in the paper when I supported this development because I chaired the committee, and to see this happening for an old man that didn't think it would be built in his lifetime, it's just real sweet.
I don't see any other announcements, so I think with that we will wrap, and that will conclude the meeting of the Policy Advisory Council. Thank you.